Hi there, I'm Evan Kleiman, host of Good Food, which is produced at this wonderful place, KCRW, which happens to be a nonprofit. I'm so happy that you want to listen to our podcast, and we're going to start it in just a few seconds. But first, because we're a nonprofit, I'd like to ask you for a little support. We have an ever-expanding village of people to help make Good Food as good as possible. So if you could spare an extra 10 bucks, we've made it really easy for you. Just text KCRW to the number 20222. That's it. Let's start the show. I have this image in my head of this 14-year-old boy who has only eaten, and this is what is so extraordinary to me, a girl from Los Angeles, has only eaten food made on the farm.
Absolutely. We weren't eating too much in other people's place because we didn't have the time, but also we felt the food was better at home.
And so literally, your family made everything you ate except for salt and olive oil?
Yeah, and fish on Friday because the fish truck will pass by, like in the countryside, you know. There's a fish truck who pass and stop at every house and you buy your fish for Friday. But otherwise, every other day, that was everything coming from the farm.
Chef Daniel Ballou grew up on his family's farm in the French countryside. And as a teenager, like many teenagers, he began acting up. So his mother managed to get him an apprenticeship at a respected restaurant in nearby Lyon. He was 14. So this moment where you find yourself in this kitchen, did you even recognize the food as food?
Oh, well, yeah, because we were using beautiful ingredients and that, you know, I mean, I used to go and pick mushroom in the field and I used to pluck birds in my farm and I used to do a lot of things I was familiar with. Nothing was strange except some ingredient. I had no clue what it was because we never had it, like avocado, like truffle, foie gras. We never really used foie gras because we were not in the southwest of France. We were in Lyon, and foie gras was expensive, so.
Today, Daniel Ballou is much more familiar with foie gras. He's a chef who sits atop an extraordinary empire of restaurants that spans the globe. From the 3 Michelin-starred Daniel in New York City, to restaurants in London, Toronto, Beijing, and Singapore. Throughout his career, he has literally seen it all. Haute cuisine, nouvelle cuisine, modernist cuisine. And in his new, very personal cookbook, he shares his fascinating journey. It's called Daniel, My French Cuisine. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. The food that you were cooking in the early part of your career, was it the nouvelle cuisine?
No, but the food was very sophisticated. The food was, to me, the best part was the sauces, the braised dish, the dishes who were quite complex in preparation and rustic at the same time.
Describe a dish that has both those things together, that incredible sophistication and yet a kind of rustic quality.
Well, for example, there's in Lyon, we do quenelle nature, which is no more than a dumpling or a gnocchi, but we do that with pike, wild pike. So to make the quenelle nature, we first have to make a crayfish butter. So we take all the crayfish, we make salad with that, and then all the heads and the body, we crush it in a mixer with butter, and then we cook that butter for hours and hours until the extraction comes. Then after, with the butter, we make a roux, and with the roux, we make also a nantua, sauce nantua, where we take more heads of crayfish and we make the sauce. And so, of course, the application with the roux was kind of old-fashioned. We were making like 50 pounds of roux a week. But then they were so generous with the sauce. And the sauce was something like between, it was not a soup, it was a sauce. But it could be drinking like a soup. And when we serve the quenelle, we will put the quenelle, which was quite big. It was a big hand-rolled dumpling of a fish mousse. And we would put that into the sauce nature. So for one person, you will have at least a quart of sauce. And we'll put that on the corner of the stove until it souffle, the quenelle souffle and become two or three times the size and absorb the sauce. And then after that, we will put a little bit of hollandaise and gratiné the thing and then send it to the dining room with crayfish around and mushroom.
So you're describing this quart of sauce and these quenelle just soaked in this rich sauce. And now we would see a plate with tiny little dots. Tiny little dots of sauce.
Yeah. We weren't using tweezers and squeeze bottle at the time, that's for sure.
So tell me what you think about that.
I love evolution in cooking in all direction, all cuisine. But you know what really happened in the 70s in France when I started to become... I started in 1969, summer of 1969. And by early 70s, that was the revolution in the French cuisine. And Michel Guérard and Alain Sandorance and Alain Chappelle and Trois Gros and Bocuse, all those great chefs, Eberlin, they were all the leader of the Nouvelle Cuisine. And there was so much happening. They were leaning on what the past taught them, but they were really transforming. But they were traveling a lot. They were starting to travel to America. They were starting to travel to Japan. And the idea of the tasting menu came from Japan because they had the kaseki menu there. And they felt, well, maybe we can serve our food in multi-course. And so that's how we started with the tasting menu in France there. And we started to have like 4, 5, 6, 8 course menu. And they were very inspired by sometimes the purity and the simplicity of Japanese cooking. And I think it kind of filtered in a little bit in the evolution of French cuisine.
And now this is another huge transitional moment for cuisine, don't you feel?
It is, but it's always in transition. And what's happening with young chefs in America, it's normal everywhere around the world because all those young chefs already had a mentor who went to Europe and trained, or who went to and worked with some of the best in the last 30 years. And nowadays, the second generation in many countries, like Brazil, like Peru and many other countries, Mexico even, I meet wonderful young chefs. Certainly, we are in a full swing of second generation of chefs already. And that's wonderful. And I think it's going to keep growing to be exciting. That's for sure.
What a pleasure. I could just talk to you about cuisine for hours. And thank you for this book. You've done a marvelous job.
Thank you.
Daniel Ballou is the chef and owner behind many restaurants around the world, including his eponymous Daniel in New York City. His beautiful new coffee table cookbook is Daniel, My French Cuisine. It's a work of art with some really engaging essays by Bill Buford. If you love food, I highly recommend it. This year has not been a good one when it comes to losing our culinary icons. First, Marcella Hazan, then Charlie Trotter, and now just this week, 57-year-old chef Judy Rogers of Zuni in San Francisco lost her battle with cancer. Her Zuni Cafe opened in 1987, and it remains a San Francisco icon. Chef, cookbook author, and former restaurateur Joyce Goldstein joins us to share some of her thoughts on the life and legacy of Judy Rogers. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, Evan.
I know that you knew Judy for a very long time.
Yes, we met when she was chef at the Union Hotel in Benicia, when she had just started cooking there and was doing sort of an Americana New England menu. She had been recommended for the job by Marion Cunningham, who had redone the Fanny Farmer cookbook, and that was the sort of menu that they wanted. And Judy cooked it, I mean, perfectly, beautifully, but she found it very limiting for her. She was really more interested in the cuisine of France and ultimately the cuisine of Italy, and she found this just a little too confining.
Did she end up working for a time with Alice at Chez Panisse?
No, actually she worked at Chez Panisse before the Union Hotel. When she was a senior at Stanford, one night she was sort of helping out and hanging out, and Alice asked her to make a vinaigrette. And the next thing you know, Alice wanted to go on a trip and asked Judy if she would do lunch at Chez Panisse. And so Judy did lunch, an impromptu lunch by herself for a couple of years, serving three courses, a soup, usually a pasta, and something left over from the night before. That's how she met Marion Cunningham, and that's how she ended up at the Union Hotel.
Let's talk about Zuni. When Judy took Zuni over, because it had been an existing restaurant, how long did it take her before she sort of found her feet and was able to express the passion that had been sort of bubbling under the surface while she had worked for everyone else?
You know, she had been working at Yellow Fingers in New York for Joe Santo, doing Italian food. And Billy West, who was one of the owners of Zuni, kept flying to New York and trying to get her to come back to Zuni. Please come to Zuni. Please take over Zuni. And she said finally she would come if they would put in a brick wood-burning oven for her. Zuni before had been sort of an eclectic Southwestern restaurant. And Billy was from the South, and I think he thought that brick oven was going in for spare ribs. And Judy said, absolutely not. I am not doing that. I'm in love with France. I'm in love with Italy. And I'm going to be cooking that kind of food. That's what I want to do. And they were so happy to have her that, in fact, they told her she could do anything she wanted. And when she put in that oven, she knew that she wanted to do not just pizzas and flatbreads, because she had heard at Chez Panisse that once you started doing pizzas in there, you never got out of it. It was pizza, pizza, pizza. She wanted a multi-leveled oven that she could do roast chicken, leg of lamb, all sorts of other dishes. And when she was thinking about the menu, she just kept saying, I want it to be simple. I want it to be simple. Why can't you just come in and get a good roast chicken?
The famous Zuni chicken, which is 5 pages of very dense type in her cookbook. So simplicity to Judy Rogers wasn't all that simple.
No, she was a fanatic. She was a fanatic about technique, not technique in the sense that the boys talk about it with machines and gizmos and foams and all that junk, but technique of getting the maximum flavor out of your ingredients. And she knew that people who were really interested in food would read her advice about pre-salting the bird, about tucking the herbs under the skin. Judy could really explain every single thing she did. The other day, I rewatched a demo of her making hamburger with Martha Stewart and how she selected the piece of chuck and how she cut it into strips and pre-salted the strips and then cut up the meat and let it sit for 8 hours before she ground it. Most people wouldn't do that. They'd go to the market, buy ground something or other, and maybe even forget to salt it until after they'd made the burger. But everything. She even put a little depression in the burger, so when it hit the pan, it re-expanded and filled that space. She thought through everything. See, she was more than just a chef. Judy was a cook.
Thank you so much, Joyce.
You're welcome, Evan. It's a sad day for us in the Bay Area and for us women chefs. We really lost a leader, a compatriot.
That was Joyce Goldstein. We've been talking about the recent death of Chef Judy Rogers of Zuni Cafe in San Francisco. Up next, Aspic. When was the last time you were served chicken salad that was all wobbly in aspic in Los Angeles? Been a while? Well, there's a new restaurant serving just that on Melrose Place. Stay tuned for Jonathan Gold's review next.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
Welcome back to Good Food. It's that time when we turn to Jonathan Gold to find out where to eat this weekend in Los Angeles. Jonathan is the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times and a weekly presence here on Good Food. Today, he's here to talk about one of the more unusual restaurants to open this year.
We're going to Marivana, which is a Russian restaurant, part of a small chain based in Moscow.
And this is in the old Bastide space.
It is indeed. And if you remember the old Bastide space, which was decorated by, you know, the single most expensive designer in Paris and had millions and millions of dollars for the art on the walls, you will be surprised when you walk into Marivana and you find that instead you find 100 birdhouses in the olive trees out front, that you find dishware that looks like something you might have picked up in a thrift store in the 70s.
Or that your booby might have had.
It's very, very booby friendly. Everything looks like your booby's dairy dishes.
Because this, in fact, is a Russian restaurant.
It is. We've both read and enjoyed Anya von Bremzen's book on Soviet cooking. And I think that this actually in some ways is a Soviet place because it has dishes that are not classic Russian dishes but are the dishes that Anya describes as having eaten all the time.
So let's get into the menu. What were some of the things you had that you liked?
There was chicken holodets, which is something that you've probably seen a dozen times and you've probably never even dared to take a bite of. It's a chicken salad at the bottom of 2 inches of aspic. It's totally frightening in its countenance. But one of the meals I went with Alina Shatkin, who you may know, she writes for LA Magazine, and she was just transported. This is what her grandmother used to bake. It's what she wanted. And this aspic is actually lovely, and it melts right away. It's not one of those, you know, things with the texture of slip and slide. And the chicken salad underneath is really good and fresh and flaky and well-seasoned. And it's a horrific dish that ends up being great, or at least very good. Other dishes in that genre, I think, is something that's on the menu as herring under a fur coat. I don't know if we've talked about it, but my one time in Russia, which was completely spent in the Moscow airport on a 10-hour layover on a transfer.
A mini Snowden experience.
I kept thinking it was very Snowden-like that he should have like a little plaque because I think he lived in that lounge for a while. And the one Russian place among all the TGI Fridays there had herring under a fur coat, and I thought it was something that they'd made up. But in fact, it's apparently a real Russian dish, which is chopped cured herring in sort of a timbal, you know, topped with like potatoes and then with grated beets. And the very top layer is sieved egg yolk.
The fur coat.
The fur coat. It's like a layer cake of beets and fish.
Was it good?
It's pretty good.
So this restaurant, is it like a Disneyland experience more than a serious food experience?
I don't think you would walk in there and expect to have the greatest food experience of your life. It just doesn't have those trappings. Some places you expect a wine list. Here, they have a zillion different kinds of infused vodka, which is very Russian. If you have one or two, then they'll like bring out various other ones during the meal so you can taste them. You can get the vodka by 300 milliliter, 500 milliliters in a heavy crystal decanter. And the horseradish vodka is so good. It's so spicy. It's like almost your dream of mixing like Philippe's mustard in equal parts of vodka.
That's so funny.
Maybe that's my dream and not yours.
No, I would definitely go for the horseradish vodka.
And like I'm saying, there's not fancy art on the walls. The plates are like your grandmother's plates and not her good plates. They're the sort of everyday plates. There are salt and pepper shakers shaped like birds on the table. And there are sort of ratty doilies.
That's very tchotchkified.
Very tchotchkified. The first time I went there, my wife turned to me and said, I just remember that tchotchka is a Russian word.
That's perfect. perfect. Mm-hmm. That's perfect.
Blini are always a huge thing at Russian restaurants, and these are cold or room temperature, and they come slick with melted butter. And you can get them with either house-cured salmon or with salmon roe, or you can go up to the very, very high ranks of caviar if you want, and you have $600 to spend. To their credit, they probably won't give you a caviar menu unless it looks like you want to be a playa.
And are there playas there?
Oh, yes, there are.
What's the best strategy for approaching this menu?
You definitely want the small dishes because it's where a lot of the interesting stuff or a lot of the really typical stuff is concentrated. So, a herring plate or a plate of salo, which is kind of Russian lardo, or they have a cold sort of borscht type thing called svekolnik, which I've probably mispronounced, which is this beautiful sort of like macedoine of vegetables in ice cold sweet and sour broth.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
And they have, which I know is one of your favorites, the Olivier salad.
Yes, salat Olivier, which in Italy is called Russian salad.
And I think it's funny because anywhere that has ever had two Russian people in it has had some version of the Olivier salad.
Describe it.
It's chopped vegetables, and you get your choice of meat in the chopped vegetables. The one time I had it with bologna because that's
because
just the kind
bologna
of
bologna has a first name.
Is it Olivier?
Maybe.
I mean, it's Russian bologna, right? So it's a little smoky and it has a little developed flavor, and there's obviously like a Russian name for it that dignifies it the way that mortadella is not just bologna.
And bologna and mayonnaise are made for one another.
Yeah. I mean, you'd think that a chopped salad with bologna and gobs of mayonnaise wouldn't be delicious.
Of course it's delicious.
In fact, it was so good that you sort of almost realize why everybody eats Olivier salad. It's because this is the one that they think they're going to get.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Gold, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Mari Vana, a new Russian restaurant on Melrose Place. Get a text message with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes by texting Good Food to the number 69866. Just text the words Good Food to 69866. Plus, all the restaurants that you hear about on Good Food are always on our restaurant map, and the map lives on our blog. Check it out. And now, for those of you not eating out this weekend, let's stop by the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Market manager Laura Avery is there this first really cold weekend of the season to tell us what we should be looking for.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report with a mid-holiday greeting to all. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving and we're looking forward to the holidays to come. We're talking today with Andrea Crawford, who's a co-owner of Kenter Canyon Farms, which is mostly known for delicious baby herbs and lettuces. Andrea has branched off into a whole new world, and it's the world of growing, milling, and baking with wheat. Andrea, tell us how the genesis of this project came to be and kind of describe the kind of wheat you're growing and what you're making with it.
Yeah, sure. Hi, Laura. Well, my husband Robert Dedlow and I are both dedicated foodies. That's how we got started with Kenter Canyon Farms. It was so that we could procure the ingredients that we wanted to have on our table. And the wheat project kind of grew out of that love as well. We have been baking bread at home for our family for many years. And it occurred to us about 3 years ago that flour comes from a plant and that maybe we should be growing it. I had a couple of little test projects that were not successful because we had wildlife that also was very interested in it and did a better job of harvesting it than we did. But last year, Robert took 50 acres that we had available in Hollister and he planted three varieties of heritage wheat that we got from Glenn Roberts from Anson Mills. He supplied us with Sonora wheat, Glen wheat, and Red Fife. and we had a very successful crop. It was all dry farm, just irrigated naturally by the rainfall. We were able to harvest 100,000 pounds of grain from that planting. And we have taken that grain and we are milling it into flour on a stone mill and baking it into bread twice a week right now and selling it at farmers markets, the Santa Monica Farmers Market on Wednesdays and Sunday Hollywood.
You know, a lot of farmers would plant winter wheat as a cover crop. Is wheat something that is sort of native and indigenous or traditionally grown in California that kind of disappeared?
Well, it hasn't disappeared. We are still a very large wheat producer in California, producing all kinds of winter wheat on a very large scale. I think that as a kind of component of multi-vegetable organizations that smaller farmers have who go to farmers markets, wheat is a little bit too long-term in the soil. It does work well as a rotational crop for bigger growers who really need to rest, like, you know, 1,000 acres of land. But it is in the ground for 9 months. And because the actual wheat doesn't fetch that much money at this point, people have to make a choice between growing wheat and growing tomatoes, which are $8 a pound. So you can see where the chips will fall on that one. But we are here as pioneers trying to get people to see this wheat, which is varieties that are hard to find. They're named varieties. They're fresh from that year to perhaps be willing to see them as a more special thing and pay the premium that it costs to bring it to the market.
And when you say premium, it's going for about $2 a pound for the whole grain and for the flour.
Yes, we've got it priced as reasonable as we can to kind of get it out there. I didn't want to make it into something precious, but it does cost us a lot more to bring it to market than it does a much, you know, larger producer because, you know, grain is and flour are commodity items and they're partly subsidized and these people are working in big numbers mm-hmm. and we just aren't going to be able to do that.
Now, you're going to be at the Wednesday market on the 18th with your mill, your portable mill, and you're going to show the process of milling the wheat grain into flour and then making some sort of a flatbread and then grilling it on a griddle until we can all taste it fresh.
Yes, that is my plan. I want to get people excited about whole grains and how they can taste really good. You don't have to do anything to it. Even an uninspired, frightened chef can pull this together.
All right, good. That was Andrea Crawford. She has begun to grow and mill and bake with flour, with grain that she grows of three varieties of wheat, selling it at two farmers markets, and people are really enjoying it. Another source of inspiration that we turn to from time to time for how to navigate the market offerings is private chef Cece Consalvo. Cece's here on a regular basis. She shops and cooks for many private clients, and she's just come out with an e-cookbook. And one of the ones that really caught my attention was your recipe for ginger soup. So let's talk about that, something nice and restorative and refreshing at this holiday time.
Yeah, it's a really nice sort of one-pot meal, if you will. And what I do is I get some fresh ginger, and you can either chop it up or grate it. I like to grate it sometimes. It almost liquefies. A little onion, a little garlic. Let's see, a little fresh cilantro that you can garnish at the end. But basically, you just put the ginger and the garlic and some onion in a pot. You get that going. You can use a vegetable broth or just water's fine. Sometimes I like to sort of clarify the broth a little bit with soy sauce or even the coconut amino acid, something like that. And then from there, what I like to do is maybe cook some noodles on the side or even get a piece of fish or chicken, cook that up, and then build the soup in a bowl. So you're basically creating this really rich broth, and then I sort of ladle it over other ingredients. You can also take some zucchini that we have at the market, and I put it on the mandolin, and I make little noodles out of it. And then, as I say, fresh cilantro, there's lime. I love garnishing with lime, the ginger and the lime together.
When you're taking that ginger and garlic and onion, are you sweating them in some olive oil first?
Absolutely. Olive okay. oil, coconut oil, mm-hmm. brown rice oil, whatever you'd like.
And the ginger here now, it's the plant. You have the whole beautiful stalk on, it looks like bamboo, and then you got this fresh ginger, and you probably don't even need to peel it.
That's so true. You're right. You just, you know, leave the skin on. It's so fresh. And then the stalks you can actually put in water and use, as I'm sure you know, use on your tablescape. Mm-hmm.
And I love the idea of doing the zucchini noodles. Mm. That's so light.
Yes, that's yeah. a really nice alternative. As I say, there's a lot of gluties out there, folks that don't want to eat the gluten. So zucchini noodles are just a great alternative.
All right, Cece. Well, thanks for that. This is very exciting to get these new recipes, and all the best.
Thank you so much, Laura. Always a pleasure.
That was Cece Consalvo, and she not only is a market regular, she has come out with a whole bunch of new recipes anybody can take a look at and then buy right here at the market. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Find a recipe for Chef Cece Consalvo's ginger soup on the Good Food blog. In a minute, don't be shocked, but it's the scratch and sniff guide to becoming a wine expert. Don't be a snob. It is, in a word, awesome. Stick around to hear about it.
Ever wish you could hear KCRW's signature music programming wherever and whenever you want? You can with Eclectic 24. Our ever-expanding all-music stream is available worldwide 24/7 online. You can listen to KCRW's diverse music mix on the go or in the car through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out. Go to kcrw.com/eclectic24.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. If you saw the movie French Kiss with Kevin Kline and Meg Ryan, do you remember that scene where he has her smell test tubes of various aromas and then drink his wine? That really made an impression on me, the idea that you can train yourself to recognize various aromas, and that will increase your understanding and appreciation of wine. Richard Betts wants us to do exactly that. Learn about wine through our noses. So he's made the kind of book that you probably haven't opened in decades. His book is The Essential Scratch and Sniff Guide to Wine. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I think it's such a fun idea.
Thank you.
Because people are so completely overwhelmed by choice.
Yep.
And they have no idea how to decide what they themselves like.
Right.
Which is the hardest thing, I think.
It is and it isn't. It's just a matter of, you know, treating it just like, what are you going to have for dinner, you know, or what fluoride are you going to take at the dentist? You know, what flavor is that going to be? Who are you going to vote for? I mean, it's totally up to you. And, you know, America's still figuring out its relationship to wine. You know, in Europe, it's millennia old and they understand its place. And for us, we're still figuring it out. Is it a cocktail? Does it belong on the table? And, you know, frankly, all of those things are right. It's up to you when you do it. But my most lofty ambition is to knock it off the pedestal, right? Just take all the fancy stuff out of the way and say, hey, this is fun, right? And if we can relate it to ourselves, so, you know, there's no wine speak, you know, you don't have to learn what a gooseberry tastes like or any of this stuff. It's a matter of understanding that the flavors we already know and the foods and tastes we already know are actually how we can describe wine. And you can say, you know what, I really like strawberries, and then we can go this direction. Or, you know what, I really don't like blackberries, and then you're not going to go that direction. And based upon a vocabulary we already have and preferences we already have, you know, we can find our way to what we should drink and enjoy really easily.
So this idea of scratching and sniffing and using a book to do it, it's totally intriguing for me. So when you first get to the scratch and sniff parts, the first choice is what?
I think the big ask, or not even an ask, it's just one of the things we need to realize is that, you know, what do we actually taste? Well, you only taste sweet, sour, salt, bitter, and if we're lucky, umami, right? And everything else that we think that we taste, we're actually smelling it. You know, strawberry doesn't have a taste. Strawberry, you know, it'll have an acidity, which will make your mouth water, and it'll have a sugar, which will feel sweet on a certain part of your tongue. But all the, associated flavor is actually, they're aromas. We're smelling them. And so with that, it's a pretty simple and almost entirely inclusive idea to break wine down into three areas of fruit, wood, and earth. Those are pretty much, you know, 90% of what flavor a wine. They're the fruit flavors and then the flavors that are or are not there based on whether it was or wasn't aged in oak. And then an earthy flavor, which may or may not exist. And so we start with fruit. And in the case of red wines, we can break it down into red fruits or black fruits.
And what's so interesting to me, and I've been exposed to a lot of wine, is how completely different they are when you isolate the aromas of those two things, red or black fruit.
Yep.
Describe what red fruit is.
You know, the red fruit, I think you'll find commonly in things like Pinot Noir or Grenache, what have you. And so we don't even have to take sides. It's not like, you know what, I like red fruits, I don't like black fruits. It's like, tonight I want something that's brighter. Let's go red.
It's exactly like how you want to cook. Like, tonight, do I want to put sriracha in something?
Totally.
Or do I want to put turmeric in it?
Mm-hmm. It's just like that. And that's the fun part. You know, you can just choose based upon your mood.
So if we're drawn to the black fruit,
right,
what would some of the wines be that we would might want to choose?
So Syrah, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, these sorts of things. They actually, and it actually mirrors it in generally speaking in terms of what it actually looks like. You know, those are darker wines to start with.
So what do we do about white wines, which aren't so what we call fruit forward?
Right. Yeah, they're a little bit more subtle, but the distinction is actually not at all subtle. I'd say, you know, citrus is a common element to all white wine. They'll all have some degree of lemon and lime in there. And, you know, some have more of it, some have less of it. But the real distinction, the further distinction to be made is, are the fruits exotic, like a pineapple or peaches, nectarines, these sorts of things, lychee, or are they more subtle, like apples and pears? It's those lines that we can draw in the sand and say, okay, if you want it more exotic, you know, something like Gewürztraminer or Muscat are these things that are very flamboyant. If you want it more subtle, some flavors of Chardonnay, some flavors of Sauvignon Blanc, these sorts of things. And so we can further divide it based on that preference.
So let's get to now the things that I think are harder for people.
Okay.
Which are the things that aren't food-like.
Right.
Except maybe bacon. But
yep. Yeah, exactly.
But wood, the idea of oak or not oak.
Right.
The thing that's so interesting to me about the wood page is that the things that you are able to scratch and sniff mm-hmm. are vanilla.
Yes.
Or dill.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, why is that?
Okay, so if we take aside the wines that are aged in like cement or stainless steel or old wood, they're going to basically have no flavor from the wood itself. And so you can, that's one choice, like I don't want any oak flavor. Or the other choice is, yeah, I do want the oak flavor. And in this case, there are you know, several types of wood used around the world, but the two predominant types are French oak and American oak, and they do taste different. The French oak, to generalize, is more subtle, and it has flavors of toast and vanilla and oftentimes smoke and nutmeg and cinnamon and this sort of, you know, these
warm
brown spices. Exactly. And then American oak will have those things too, but it also adds dill and coconut. It's a more flamboyant thing. Sort of, I don't know.
That's like wild.
It is wild. Yeah, it's cool. You know, it's a different species.
So, and then we go to earth, which is what everybody calls terroir, right?
Exactly, right. How place influences the wine in every way. At the surface, it's the hardest sort of ask for the drinker. Like, you know, what do you mean earth? It doesn't smell earthy. Or what does earthy smell like? And this is, again, where you have to make it intensely personal. And so when it comes to earth, it's not like, oh, does it smell like dirt or doesn't it? It could. It could also smell like the potting soil you spilled in the garage. It could smell like the river stones that you slipped on your last camping trip. It can smell like mushrooms. It can smell like the woods in fall. It can smell like the pavement in Los Angeles in the summer that's been so hot and you get a rainstorm. And you know how good that smells, like that rain coming off of the hot concrete? That's earthy too. So it's anything tertiary that influences it.
I really think you're doing such an amazing service.
Thank
for
you.
People, because it just strips away all of the classist
right.
parts
absolutely.
Of wine. And it really is just you and your own nose.
It's very democratic.
Thank you so much, Richard.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Really, really fun. The thing that's so fun about it is you think, oh yeah, a scratch and sniff book about wine. And then you go on the adventure and you watch everything that you yourself enjoy fall into place.
Yep. It's amazing, isn't it?
Amazing. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
That was Richard Betts. His book is The Essential Scratch and Sniff Guide to Becoming a Wine Expert. We have this incredible chart on our blog where you can map out exactly what kind of wine you like to drink based on if you prefer subtle or exotic flavors, oak or no oak, and so forth. I've done it, and trust me, it's a bit mind-blowing. What if you went to the doctor with a stomach ache, and instead of Pepto, he gave you a bottle of really herbally Amaro? Well, not too long ago, that was commonplace. And in some countries, spirits are still encouraged in place of medicine. And I don't mean vodka. I mean liqueurs made from herbs, roots, spices, and other botanicals. George Cassette of Silver Lake Wine is with me in the studio to discuss the lineage of spirits that used to be medicine. Hi.
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm good. Whenever this comes up as a subject for me, I always imagine the Middle Ages and some Carthusian monk somewhere with their little strange haircut over a vat of something, almost like a witch. Does that have any validity?
Absolutely. But it goes back a lot further than that. So when I was in the Republic of Georgia a few years ago, and I ran into this fellow who is a speaker there, and he was his name is Patrick McGovern, and he's a sort of a molecular anthropologist. So he was talking about the dating of ancient wine vessels and tracing back how long people had been making what was wine, and he's found things that he thought people in ancient times had found that were now being looked at for even as serious maladies as anti-cancer. And he felt that a lot of stuff had been discovered and was lost. And so these guys are going back and looking at some of these compounds that were made in ancient times by, you know, somebody akin to an alchemist or more of a priest.
Like a shaman.
Sort of. So they've found evidence of pottery jars in Neolithic China that date back to 7,000 BC. That's the Chinese's figure. And then there's a text called the Ebers Papyrus or Ebers Papyrus. It's a compilation of Egyptian medical texts. And that text is dated back to 1550 BC in Egypt. And at this point, they were using things like, well, wormwood comes up a lot.
Wormwood being the famous base for absinthe.
Yes. They used it for various things, loss of appetite, upset stomach, gallbladder, stimulating sexual desires, etc.
You know, it's interesting because when I think about the modern equivalent of what some of these would be, I think of Amaro.
Right. And that came quite a bit later. You would see Amari showing up in the 16th, maybe 17th century. Some of your more adamant spirits fans will know Carpano Antica Formula. It's cited to be the first vermouth. And this Carpano fellow grew up in the hills around Torino. And this was then the Duchy of Savoy. And so this is just over the hill from Chartreuse, and they thought he had probably in his youth tasted something that monks made over their cauldrons and incorporated this into this fashionable beverage.
So it's sort of fascinating that this relationship between Amaro and Chartreuse. Now, what about Genever or Genever?
Okay, well, just to back up a little bit, Chartreuse is actually an example of what is called Genepi, if I'm pronouncing that right, or Genepe, which is a local alpine spirit. And most of the time, I think that people just steep local herbs. Genepe is a type of absinthe. They use that, among other things, to make these really wonderful aromatic things. And that is thought the Carthusian monks supposedly got their recipe from some guy who had a centuries-old formula that was probably developed by some alchemist somewhere, and then they developed it. The other thing that you'd ask me about was gin, and it's credited to someone, a Dutch physician, sometime in the 17th century, but it seems that at least the use of juniper berries had been around for longer than that. And they used anise, caraway, coriander, as well as the juniper. And this was originally done as sort of a cure and, again, you know, developed into a liquor.
Do you have a cocktail that you love using these kind of liqueurs you could share with us, or a tincture maybe that you're experimenting with?
I mean, I'm not much of a cocktail maker. I tend to be more of a drink it straight type guy. But there's a few things that I could mention that I think are really interesting. for sure, chartreuse, of course, the one thing about this, chartreuse is very expensive. But the if you really want to hear the angels sing, the chartreuse VEP, it's $170 or $60 or something like that. But it's aged, and it's probably the most amazing thing you'd ever try. If you see it in a bar, get a glass, unless you win the lottery. But the other thing that, as I mentioned, I think before, the Genepay, G-E-N-E-P-Y, Dolan, who's a really fine producer of vermouths, is making this now. It's very affordable. It has many of the flavors of chartreuse. Carpano Antica formula as a sweet vermouth just by itself is fantastic. There's another nice one called Bonal, which is a French aperitif. It has gentian and quinine and you know, some of the other herbs that are in chartreuse, although it's more like an Amaro, I would say.
Wow, if you cut yourself, you could pour it over you and you'd be completely taken care of.
Exactly. And I would like finally to put in a plug for two of my favorite beverages, one of which there really isn't much choice is aquavit from Ligne, and also various Genever gins. The Bowles aged Genever is outstanding, and Anchor Distilling makes a nice domestic one.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That was George Cassette from Silver Lake Wine. We've been talking about some liqueurs that used to be medicine. A list of his recommended medicinal spirits is on the Good Food blog. Up next, we've got another Michelin-starred chef here with his gorgeous new book. David Kinch of Manresa is in the studio with me next.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. I'm really fascinated by how chefs at the top level differentiate themselves. I mean, they're not all doing techno things. Some have a really deep understanding of place that they express. Others are craftsmen, for whom it's all about hands-on, traditional manipulation of ingredients. Or maybe they're one of the very few who manages to create a plate that's a distillation of all of it into a very personal expression. Meet the extraordinary David Kinch. His restaurant, Manresa, in Los Gatos near Santa Cruz, is his ongoing project to make diners very, very happy. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. That was great.
I'm glad you liked it. Give us a snapshot of your cooking. Make it as visual as possible. Maybe you could describe a dish you're working on now.
I like to think of our food as being a complex simplicity. One of the main mantras in the kitchen is when we're looking at a dish and the editing process, which is important in everything we all do, is we make that decision on when is the final thing we can take off the plate, as opposed to what's the last thing we can add. We look at a plate and we pull things off, whether it's an element or a concept, until it's stripped naked, but it's still a complete dish and still a complete concept, and it says what we want it to say and has the flavors we want it to have. And that's when we stop.
Yet your food, when you look at it, it's highly plated, almost like looking at an artist's palette, each dish. There's color, there's balance of the visual. When I look at the photographs in the new book, Manresa, it just seems to me that it's a really interesting combination of a very intellectual investigation on your part as well as something very grounded in a place.
That's great. I mean, I don't want to say we, you know, consciously strive for it, but I think that kind of hits the nail on the head. I think, you know, when you're cooking, you know, a personal food in a personal style, which you really work hard your whole life to try to achieve, you want it to be a distillation. You want it to your food to be a, you know, an extension of, you know, your cultural references, your likes, your dislikes. You know, it sounds funny, but, you know, I like to cook what I like to eat and I don't cook what I don't like to eat. And, you know, I have favorites and then I don't have favorites. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why food is so dynamic. You know, things change. You have new interests and maybe a new product, maybe some sort of new inspiration, whether it can be a book or a travel, you know, walking through a market. It can be a smell. It can be a perfect eggplant. You know, that's part of the fun of what we do.
Or in your case, this extraordinary relationship that you have with one farm. Mm-hmm.
Love Apple Farms, Cynthia Sandberg and Love Apple Farms.
It's a really unusual relationship. Give us a sense of how deep this relationship is and what exactly they supply to you.
It is complex. It is complex. I've known Cynthia for about 8 years now. She was a champion tomato grower. She was a tomato hobbyist, and she was a former trial attorney. And she loved to grow tomatoes. And she came into the restaurant for a birthday. And I had been alerted to the fact that she was a tomato grower. And, of course, I asked her. And she didn't sell to restaurants, but she made an exception and sold to us. And this is right around the time I was flirting, perhaps naively, of like growing products for myself, as if I didn't have plenty enough to do, you know. So I actually looked for plots of land, and I was talking to farmer friends of mine about if they would help me evaluate the land, or, you know, is this good, bad, how can I go about and do this. I had interest from a couple of people about actually doing this, and Cynthia was really passionate about it, and we agreed upon certain things on principle. We started at a smaller farm. From where she is now, she has 22 acres now, but she started at her old house.
I understand she even filled in her swimming pool.
Yes, it was amazing. I mean, we basically shook hands, and though she had a very large garden at the property, she planted every single square inch of the place, and we started small. You know, we started small, and, you know, we had a lot of successes, and, you know, we had a lot of failures. The relationship is not about locavorism. It is not a food politics statement. It is a qualitative statement. It's very close to the restaurant. It's only 15 minutes. It just gives us, you know, another level of control about the product that comes into the kitchen, which is really the most important thing when it comes down to it. We're not dogmatic about it. I have people who I've been buying asparagus from and strawberries from for 20 years, you know, going back to my old restaurant. And I will continue to buy strawberries and asparagus from because it's the best.
If you're just tuning in, I'm talking to David Kinch, chef and owner of Manresa in Los Gatos. The restaurant's received 2 Michelin stars for 6 years in a row. And this year, he has a gorgeous new book out called Manresa, An Edible Reflection. One of the things that we hear about so much these days and we get to see because of this, you know, the pervasiveness of food television and what's posted on the internet is how so many chefs of a certain level manipulate food a lot. Here you have this place that produces the best of what can be produced in this area in which you're cited. How important is you to maintain some of the original texture of things, for example, a carrot?
Well, it's very important. I mean, you know, as chefs developing a style, as they mature as a person and mature as a cook and as a professional, almost always we see people simplifying. They start to have, you know, an inner confidence in their ability to cook and how to present things simply and not to be showy and not to be gimmicky and not to put too many things on the plate. Everybody steps back when they get older, and I don't think it's because they're lazy or anything like that. They understand the power of ingredients, the pervasive power of ingredients, both, you know, for taste and for texture, for, you know, some sort of emotional connection, and that really what their job is bringing this out. And that's the real skill. It's not manipulating a carrot. It's like finding a carrot and making that carrot taste as much as that carrot can possibly taste. And as cooks, we can't change the laws of physics. You know, we can't take a mediocre carrot and make it taste like the best carrot in the world. It gets back to sourcing and buying the best you can possibly buy.
But lest the listener think that what you're doing is what some have derisively called figs on a plate, you are definitely using technical skills to coax the best out of those ingredients and create something that, in my mind, looking at your food, is almost spiritual or metaphorical. I mean, you have something in your mind that is not just leaves of broccoli or a beautiful head of cauliflower. You are playing with it. What are some of the techniques that you have found that we might call more, quote, modernist, that to you is an actual real tool as a mature chef, someone who just says, oh, well, this is something else that I can use to get just even more flavor out of what I'm doing?
Yeah, great question. We use a lot of different techniques. We use really, really classical techniques and very, very old techniques. You know, we cook things in clay pots. We cook things in salt crusts. We cook things very, very slowly, you know, resting ovens, that sort of thing. And we also use hydrocolloids. You know, there's hydrocolloids that we use. It is a thickener. It is a modified starch in general. It's a modified starch. It could be a xanthan gum or a gelatin gum, which tends to be, you know, fermented enzymes from wheat
Lily
products
bats.
And that sort of thing. And we use them, not all the time, but in specific incidences where the powers of these techniques or these products will lend a helping hand. But our rule is in the kitchen is you can never see it. A dish does not leave our kitchen in which the most important thing, the most obvious thing, is a technique.
In the book, you talk about pushing yourself. Mm-hmm. How you, all of you in the restaurant, your staff, you really want everyone to push themselves, whatever that means personally for each person. And I have to say that looking at the book, and it is a book of fine dining recipes on which you haven't compromised at all, which I think is really fascinating. And so many of the recipes will have a lot of different components. And I can look at a recipe and think, oh, I could actually do that component at home.
Mm-hmm.
Like
yes.
The way you use xanthan gum, for example.
Mm-hmm.
What other ways do you think what you're teaching us in this book, you can encourage people to sort of push themselves a little bit out of their comfort zone to learn something that they can really accept and incorporate?
Yeah. Well, none of the recipes have been dumbed down. I mean, everything is done the way we did at the restaurants. And there are some very simple recipes in there. And, of course, there's recipes with more ambition. But you're right. There are components. You know, the so-called complex recipes are usually a series of simpler recipes broken down that come together, you know, in a composition or, you know, in finishing. And it's those components. You can have a fancy dessert, but you can make the ice cream in it if you want. But we encourage people to start, you know, with the simpler things, you know, things that they feel that within their comfort level. And then if they master it and they're happy with the results, then you want to get better. You want maybe try something with a little bit more ambition and see how it works out. Cooking is one of those things because you're working with your hands and it's so therapeutic that the more you know about it, the more you practice and the more comfortable you feel, the more enjoyment you're going to get out of it. And the more proficient you get, the happier people are going to be.
Thank you so much, David.
My pleasure. This has been great.
That was David Kinch. His new book is Manresa, An Edible Reflection. We have one of his gorgeous recipes and equally beautiful photos from the book on our blog. If you missed any part of today's show, don't worry because you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. A big thanks to the Good Food team. That's Jillian, Laryl, Sarah, Harriet, Ronnie, Gary, and Caroline. I'm Evan Kleiman. Please join me back here next week where we'll have another edition of Good Food for you.